Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again. Humpty Dumpty, 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 Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. Humpty Dumpty learned from the fall. Humpty Dumpty hated the wall. All the king's men and all the children were not allowed to climb the wall again. Humpty Dumpty, 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 Humpty Dumpty.
Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network. Your host for today's show is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy. So get a spot of tea, sit down and relax, because it's time for another show on the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network.
Well, Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. Or didn't he have a great fall? Well, let's look back and see how this whole thing started with Donald Trump. Remember when I said that the Republicans just wanted a big smash to build their voting lists, which were very low, and they needed a big voting list? Well, that got the people all excited, and they turned out in the primary, and since Trump was appealing to some of the things that they really were interested in it, he ended up winning the primary. Now, remember what I said? I think he's a shill, which I still do, Because remember, his family and the Clinton family are good friends. Yeah, they hung out together. They went to weddings together. They had dinners together. And who knows what other things they had together. So what's going on here? That's not usually the way people operate. Well, Donald Trump is a showman. He's a businessman, but he's a showman, just like all big politicians. But he's a real showman. And I'm saying that they got to him and said, well, in fact, Bill Clinton told him you should run for president. I mean, that's a matter of record. So they get together and say, look, I think we could pull a real wing dinger here. Yeah. You run for president and you know how to get the crowds going crazy, and they'll go crazy, and you'll end up winning the Republican nomination. Plus, it'll get more people to the polls so that the election looks like something real instead of a farce, because the Republican Party is losing ground everywhere. So guess what? He wins the primary, and then what happens right away? He goes into the regular secondary part of the election, and what happens? He starts saying dumb shit all over. He said dumb shit in the primary, but people overlooked it because everybody was excited, you know. And they're still excited going into the secondary, but things changed, didn't they? He started saying more ridiculous things, more crazy things. And so the polls kept going up and down and up and down. And then finally, of course, everybody that knew anything knew that these tapes were around. Anybody like Donald Trump or anybody else, Bill Clinton, they've got all this baggage. It's out there. All they have to do at the right time is pull it out and use it. So, also what was happening was that he was like riding around in a balloon, and every time he'd go up, they'd turn the valve and gas would escape, and down he'd come, up and down, like a regular balloon ride. And now we're right down to the end. Now, if you've read Blood Feud, as I have, that book by Klein, or if you've listened yet to the audio that we're sending out to you from the book, you get a pretty good idea what's going on here. Because Hillary could not have won against a normal run-of-the-mill Republicans. Any of the ones in the primary, I don't think she could beat them, you know. Now, that's not saying I'm happy with it, because none of these people are on our side. As white separatists, none of them. We don't have a dog in the fight other than watching them kill each other if we can and encourage it. So, anyhow, Hillary had so much baggage that no normal Republican could not have beat her. There's no doubt about that. But they have to destroy Trump for her to win now. And there's still going to be a few million people vote for Trump, but they don't know what's going on. And after this is all over and Hillary is carefully installed, some of the truth might get leaked out. The truth is always around. You just have to dig for it. But this is what I've been telling you all along from the very beginning, and I think you're finding that I am right. Of course, no lone wolf or white separatist should have considered either one of these people at all. The evidence is all there, man, on both of them. So why would anybody who claims to be a lone wolf, white, racist separatist follow either one, or even the third party one? He's nuttier than a fruitcake, a libertarian. And the libertarians always went for open borders. They've kept their mouth shut a little bit lately, but for decades they've been for open borders. So, of course, that was a ridiculous. You would not want to go with those people. So it's for us just to watch. Watch the game as it unfolds. And we're going to have Hillary Clinton. There's no doubt about that. And it's going to be interesting. And then she's going to appoint her kind of judges of the Supreme Court. It's all going down anyhow. It's just a matter of years or a couple of decades. It's got to crash. It's got to crash. So don't worry about it. It's all a big fun and games. It's all fun and games, boys and girls. Well, I see Princeton University got hit with a whole lot of emails, racist emails. They're trying to determine who did it. Who sent those racist emails? We're going to get them, and we'll kick them out of the university, and then we'll ruin their lives, you know. Quotation, quotes, the university deplores these revolting messages which are contrary to our values and our code of conduct, unquote. I wonder how many of those professors are punching out little boys and stuff like that. All those universities, the higher element in the universities, they got dirty ones all over the place. But they have a code of conduct, and racism is contrary to their values. We will not allow these hateful actions to undermine our commitment to creating an inclusive, that's race mixing, and harassment-free community. Harassment, it to them, is you sending out a racist email. That's harassing. Saying that you believe in the sanctity of the white race, keep it white and keep it separate. That's harassment. School officials didn't elaborate on the contents of the emails, but the student newspaper, the Daily Princetonian, traced the emails to a white supremacist group called White Genocide Project. The email had a subject line, vote against No Child Left White, vote Trump. Well, that's true. And was sent from a non-university email address by someone using the name John Albert Willis, the report said. The message read in part, Princeton teaches its white students that they are immoral and contemptible if they don't support white genocide. And the Princeton professors say they're anti-racist, which they are as anti-white. The email that was sent to members of the Princeton University Latinx Perspectives Organization and others was nearly identical to a sample one posted on the White Supremacist Group's website. The Daily Princetonian reported, if any students at Harvard, Yale, or Princeton read this, we could use some help right now getting email addresses that we don't have access to at all three schools, since we're planning a mass racist email send out in a week or two. A September 22nd blog post on the White Genocide Project website read, the university says its Department of Public Safety, the Goon Squad, and Office of Information Technology are investigating the emails. Wow. Anyone with knowledge of the distribution of the messages is asked to contact the Department of Public Safety at 609-258-1000. Well, give them a call. Tell them Tom Metzger did it. Anyone receiving such messages is asked to contact either Public Safety, Debbie Bizarski, Manager of Diversity of Inclusion in the Office of Human Resources at 609-258-9460, or Sherry Burgess, Director of Institutional Equity at 609-258-8504, or the university hotline, 866-478-9804. And you can point out who you think is doing this dastardly deed. They don't get this excited when a nigger jumps out of the trees on a white girl and rapes her, you know. They don't get that excited. That info comes from our buddy Stray Dog in New Germany. Well, 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 they're nasty Islamic State people. Modules and lone wolves in India have lately been instructed by their handlers to focus on hacking their targets, particularly foreign citizens, to death with big chopping knives or machetes. Well, they don't cost near as much as a drone, for Christ's sake. We have gathered that IS modules and lone wolves here are being told by their handlers not to risk gathering explosives, assembling IEDs, or illegally buying automatic weapons for attacks. Instead, all they need to do is buy a big chopping knives or machetes, which would neither raise suspicion nor involve a huge cost. You see, these guys are smart. That's what you call guerrilla warfare, a senior intelligence official told this paper. Gee whiz. They don't have millions of dollars to spend. So they're doing it on the cheap. In the first case, the IS-inspired youths plotting beheadings came to light in July when a module led by the terrorist Masudyun, alias Abdu Musa, was busted by the West Bengal CID and machetes recovered. Oh my God. They should have stuck to dirty bombs, I guess. Now the members of the Kerala Tamil Nadu module arrested last week have revealed that they too plan to attack foreigners and hack them to pieces in two southern states. I guess that's in India. The motive behind the proposed hacking attacks in India, according to top sources in intelligence agencies, is to create maximum impact in terms of terrorizing people. Of course, that's what terrorism is all about. Given the gore and horror associated with them, and grab eyeballs, including that of an international audience. Well, yeah, but wait a minute. Don't we maximize terror by bombing wedding parties and wiping out funeral processions and bombing hospitals and little kids in the hospital? That's civilized warfare. That's accepted. Don't do it with a machete, though. That's old hat. But it works. Agencies believe ISIS-inspired youth may also be looking to record these hijackings or hackings and share the photos and videos with their handlers so that they can be uploaded on IS's online forums to promote the outfit in India. Well, there have been things like that going on in India for hundreds of years. I forget all the names of those groups. I remember one was the Thuggies. I think it was those people who snuck up on you and walking down a street and stuck a knife in you. Or they grabbed you when you're out on the trail between cities walking with your produce and put a thing around your neck and strangled you. This trend was seen in Bangladesh with the Dhaka attackers capturing the hacking of foreigners during the July 1st hostage situation in Holly Artisan Cafe with their smartphones. These photos were later uploaded to ISIS. Well, you want to have guerrilla warfare on the cheap? What are you going to say? It has been noticed that the ISIS modules are now largely operating as small, localized groups in different states. I think somebody's listening to my show. Quit that, you guys. You don't even send me any donations. particularly the Maharashtra and the Kerala and the Tamil Nadu and the Telangana and the Karnataka. After the NIA busted a planned Pan-India module in January, leading to 24 arrests across the nation, southern and western states, ISIS handlers have been encouraging Indian contacts to work in smaller groups with minimal interconnectivity. Jeez, I better quit putting out a show. These guys are stealing all my shit. This is to escape surveillance and minimize arrests in case a module is detected, an intelligence officer said. Wow. In the case of the Kerala Tamil Nadu module busted recently, these arrests are believed to have gathered for a meeting of the Kananapapapapala hilltop in Kannur to discuss plans for acquiring machetes when an NIA team based on a specific intelligence alert closed in on them and arrested 5 people. Well, you better get your orders into China for the machetes, because you can't get them any cheaper anyplace else. You can get them before Christmas. Hey, give me my machete, baby. Don't tell the blacks in South Chicago about this. Blacks in Africa use those machetes all the time to chop the heads off other black people. Though they were discussing targeting Jews, wow! The plan, as per our assessment, was to hack foreigners to death in tourist hotspots like Kerala and Tamil Nadu, an intelligence officer said. In case of the West Bengal module, the accused were arrested after they bought the machetes and before they could hack the members of a family that night. But we decided against waiting for the Kerala TNU to acquire the knives and machetes before arresting them, the officer said. So the officers beat the hell out of them with machetes. No, wait a minute. However, the threat of hacking attacks still looms, with many radicalized Indian youths in touch with IS handlers and motivators online. I guess the Indian youth aren't real happy with their conditions in India. Why would they gravitate to ISIS? We are keeping them under surveillance and would ask the agencies concerned to arrest them as and when the threat of their planning or executing an attack becomes imminent, the officers say. Well, there you go. Watch out. You know, like the Leathernecks, Marines, we're going to have to go back. You know, one of these neck braces you put around your neck, well, you're going to have to make it out of rubber because they're going to chop your head off if you don't. Another blurb in here about the Islamic State connected to Bangladesh says John Kerry. Anything Kerry knows you can find out on the internet. He's the biggest bunch of bullshit running out of Washington. You know, boys and girls, I took a break there for a few minutes. Call my contacts in China. The guys that bring me all those weapons of mass destruction from the Middle East after they're used one time and then thrown aside. I say, look, boys, I think there's going to be a good market for those machetes in this country. And they said, yeah, there might be. I said, well, look, I want to order 10,000 machetes, and I want them to deliver here in Indiana. You can bring them back the regular route in your boats, come up the Mississippi, up the Ohio River, up the Wabash River, and you can come into a, probably get a not too big a boat into a stream not far from my house. And they said, well, we'd like to do that. We love to do business with you, Metzger. You good customer. And I said, thank you, Ling To, Long Dong. But he said, we have problem. I said, what's that? He said, we've tried this before with other countries, and we have a lot of rowdy sailors on these boats. The crews, they drink lots, they take lots of dope, and they fight. They get out of hand, and then they take the machetes, which are shipping out, and chop the rest of the crew up till there's nobody left. We can't afford, our insurance will not cover doing that anymore. So I'm sorry, Mr. Metzger. Long dong here. We cannot do that. We can't ship you 10,000 machetes. You may have to go to Mexico. They got lots of them down there. Oh, that's right. I didn't think about that. Mexico is loaded with people with machetes, and they know how to use them, too. We could get instructors to come up here from Mexico with them and train the people right here in the back 40. Ah, you smart man, Mr. Metzger. Signing off. Long dong. You know, I can always count on those Chinese. They come through for me every time. Well, I see the British government addresses violence against women in new social media crimes reforms. New sections including guidelines for the treatment of violence against women and girls, hate crimes, and vulnerable victims. Wow. Well, the problem I've got, what about the violence against men by women? Because I think as these women get bigger and fatter and more muscular, they're attacking men a lot more. You got to watch it in these bars with these big fat dykes on trikes. How come the government's not protecting men, especially white men? Ask them that, will you? Oh, I knew we'd get to that. I knew we'd get there pretty soon. This is over in jolly old UK, England. The Crown Prosecution Service, CPS, has today published new guidance concerning prosecutions of those who use social media to spread hate and discord. The guidance covers such unsavory and online activities as common or garden trolling, baiting, underage sexting, virtual mobbing, harassment campaigns, and doxing, encouraging harassment by revealing someone's personal details. We ain't gonna let that happen no more. Today is the beginning of the Hate Crimes Awareness Week, so it is rather apt time for the CPS to issue this guidance. The Director of Public Prosecutions, Allison Saunders, a woman, signed off the new guidance, which also contains new sections concerning violence against women and girls, hate crime and vulnerable victims. The DPP said that while social media is designed to be a positive tool of education, if they tote the Hillary Clinton line, entertain and enlighten. Well, we're enlightening. We're enlightening. Why not? Some users twist its purpose for bullying instead of bomber raids on villages. They're pushing people around. Have you ever been bullied in the street? I don't remember being bullying in the street. Those who commit these acts or encourage others to do the same can and will be prosecuted. Be persecuted is more like it. The police and the courts will use the new guidance to decide whether criminal charges will be brought against perpetrators of free speech and then the above types of social media abuse. Individuals that participate in free speech on these online love crimes could be charged with an offense under the Serious Communications Act of 2007. Today's new guidance comes in the wake of a major report earlier this year that found that 1 in 4 teenagers is subjected to abuse on the line. Yeah, I saw one on the line the other day. He said, "You're an asshole." Well, you are too. Boy, that's a hateful thing. The Independent reminds us that the survey is that report suggesting that 24% of teens were targeted and abused on the internet due to their gender, sexual orientation, race, religion, disability, or transgender identities. In 2015 and 16, more hate crime prosecutions were completed than ever before, with 4 out of 5 prosecuted cases resulting in a conviction. Well, they're going to make the lawyers a lot of money over there in jolly old England. But what happens when it gets beyond your control? You're going to call out the Army and the Navy? No, they're too busy over in the Middle East. They can't help you out. Well, all I can tell you is the more you bitch about it, the more it'll happen. So you're spreading it, you're not stopping it. Well, I got a new book out, boys, from the inside cover. The Globalization of Hate, Internationalizing Hate Crime, is the first book to examine the impact of globalization on our understanding of hate speech and hate crime. Bringing together internationally acclaimed scholars with researchers and policymakers and practitioners from across the world, it critically scrutinizes the concept of hate crime as a global phenomenon, seeking to examine whether hate crime can or should be conceptualized within the international framework, and if so, how this might be achieved. Beginning with the global dynamics of hate, the contributions analysis whether hate crime can be defined globally, whether universal principles can be applied to the phenomenon, how hatred is spread by the British, the French, the German, Russian sometimes, the U.S. Army. That's how it's, hate is spread. The middle portion of the book moves beyond the broader questions of globalization to jurisdictional examples of how globalization impacts upon our understanding of and also our responses to hate crime. Boy, this is an intellectual book. You better get it if you need a new doorstop. You remember that anthrax attack back 10-15 years ago when they got it into the Congress or something? Do you remember that stuff? Well, there's somebody here who wants to comment on it, so I'm going to let her comment on it, okay? Just a minute. Let me get it set up here for us.
Directly after the nation was in a paralyzed state of fear from the attacks of 9/11, the anthrax attacks happened. Terrorism was no longer localized. It was now something that could happen to anyone, anywhere. Now, 11 years on, and with the main suspect dead, the case is closed. Or is it? Do we really know the truth? And why are these attacks significant? To help me break it all down, I'm joined by Robbie Martin, journalist for MediaRoots.org. Hey, Robbie. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, Abby. How you doing?
Good. So, Robbie, we hear almost every day still by the media and political establishment, 9/11. The threat of terrorism. We don't hear that much about the anthrax attacks anymore. Why is this, and why were they so significant, and what did they really do to the American psyche?
Well, 9/11 was an isolated incident, and, you know, it happened in New York City. It affected, you know, 3,000 people and a lot more lives, you know, as repercussions from that, but the anthrax attacks took it out of a localized, isolated incident and made people feel as if they could be attacked in their own homes. You know, someone who lives in a remote area in the mountains could be sent a letter with anthrax in it. And basically you have the idea of terrorism escalated to the point where, you know, it could come at any time to anyone, basically.
Yeah, and that really did preempt, as I said before, you know, the whole Iraq invasion, the biological weapons, the duct tape on the windows. Better duct tape your windows, otherwise, you know, the biological weapons are going to come in your home, as if that would protect you anyway. But based on the evidence that we know, Robbie, about the anthrax attacks that the government has admitted, that the media has uncovered, what is the best case scenario looking at what we already know to have really happened?
Well, the best case scenario isn't that good, and that's the disturbing part. The best case scenario is that the people in power during the Bush administration, who wanted to push through the Iraq war, used the fear levels at the time to basically plant the seeds for the propaganda of the Iraq war by leaking to the press through ABC, through the Wall Street Journal. John McCain went on David Letterman talking about how the anthrax came from Saddam Hussein, Saddam Hussein's supposed biological weapons program. And, I mean, yeah,
So the best case scenario is that they use it to ratchet up the fear, to really get everyone on board with the Iraq invasion and using that threat. And they never really did come out and say that the anthrax was not the Muslim terrorist that they said. It just kind of went under the radar, Robbie. But now that we know that members of the Bush administration were on Cipro, and also the targeted members that were in opposition to the Patriot Act, I mean, what do you think the worst case scenario is now that we know these kind of damning facts?
Oh, the worst case scenario is that, I mean, the motives are questionable. I mean, why would someone who's a terrorist who wanted to, you know, a Muslim terrorist, why would they want to send anthrax letters to people who are opposing the Patriot Act? I mean, you have to wonder, you know, I can only speculate what the worst case scenario is, but someone who sent those letters wanted to shut down the Senate. They wanted to get the Patriot Act passed, and they wanted to ratchet up the levels of fear so high that people would feel as if terrorist attacks will continue, and that 9/11 was not a singular event, that it would continue indefinitely.
And who benefited, though? I mean, if this is so, if it really was a conspiracy or just a cover-up, I mean, at the highest levels of government, who did benefit from the anthrax attacks?
Well, I mean, the people who were behind PNAC benefited immensely from it. I mean, they got their dream. They were able to invade Iraq essentially based off of this, the idea that Saddam was behind the anthrax attacks. The term WMDs became a household term because of the anthrax attacks. Colin Powell wouldn't have been able to go to the UN and hold up that vial and convince all of them, or, you know, I don't know if they were convinced, but he, you know, managed to make the case at the time that Iraq was a threat. And not, you know, and another side of it completely is that it restarted a bioweapons arms race that went in the face of a treaty that was ratified in, I think, the early 70s, banning bioweapon development. And now, since 9/11, we have $50 billion being poured into this new biodefense industry. And who knows how many people are making weaponized anthrax now, because now private industry, the private sector, is making and weaponizing anthrax on behalf of the government.
Great point, Robbie. It's really something to take into account, is that other side of the profit-making industry about this. But Ivins is dead. Bruce Ivins is dead. Case is closed. The FBI said that they would present their case against Ivins. Have they done that? And is there any evidence really against Ivins here?
I mean, the evidence is flimsy at best. I mean, right after he, you know, supposedly committed suicide, the FBI went and did a press conference presenting their case to the American public. And, you know, the guy who presented this case, he's sweating, he's stuttering while the press is asking him questions. And the best evidence they came up with is that Bruce Ivins had a history of mental illness. Well, I'm sorry, but 1 in 5 Americans suffers from mental illness. That's statistically shown. So that's not proof of his guilt. That's a smear campaign. And then on top of that, the physical evidence they say that they have is a flask that was found in his home that contained anthrax spores, the same spores that were at Fort Detrick, Maryland. Well, if you work with anthrax and you're a bioweapons lab technician, I mean, the chances of you having traces of the same spores that you're working with at your place of employment at home are pretty likely. That still has no bearing on his guilt or anything like that. It's completely baseless.
It is definitely baseless, Robbie. We haven't seen that evidence yet. And, you know, like Obama said, the case is closed. Thank you so much for coming on, breaking it all down. I know you've been researching this for a while. Robbie Martin, MediaRoots.org. So what motives would Ivins have to send anthrax to the most vocal opponents of the Patriot Act? Or why were members of the Bush administration and the press on Cipro, the anthrax antibiotic, before the attacks occurred? Why weren't the people who died and were infected important enough to also be warned to take Cipro when it could have saved their lives? Most importantly, with so many unsolved mysteries, why did Obama not only order the investigation to end, but threaten to veto any more funding to examine the truth? That's the question we should all be asking.
You know, this government all the time worries about your weapons. they don't want anybody to worry about their weapons and their weapons of mass destruction. I think it's time to go back to the states. divided up again. Independent states. We don't need a government like we got in Washington. We don't need any of these crooked, rotten presidents either. Let's get rid of all that bullshit. Hey, what's going on over in Syria? Nobody tells me nothing. So here's somebody that will.
New Crosstalk Stories in the media. I'm joined by my guest here in Moscow, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Alex Crucifora. He is the director and writer for the Duran.com. And in Tehran, we cross to Mohammed Mirandi. He is an associate professor at the University of Tehran. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I very much appreciate it. Let's first go to Tehran. Mohammed, you know, on this program, we've discussed at great length over the years the crisis in Syria, and very often, particularly in the last few months, last year, we've looked at Moscow and Washington. Please give us the perspective coming out of Tehran and as they look at the events being played out in Syria right now.
Well, if your viewers go back to 5-6 years ago on this very same show, the argument that we were putting forward, people like myself and what we were saying is basically the same as what we're saying today. And that is that the civil unrest in Syria was linked largely to outside influence, the violence. There were people who were protesting, they had legitimate grievances, and the armed forces or the police, they did kill some people. But many more people, for example, in Egypt in August 14, 2013, many more people were killed there, but the United States didn't create a civil war in Syria, in Libya, in Egypt. Or, for example, in the case of Turkey, we now see huge violence in the south of the country, in the east of the country, but no one complains about the Turkish government, and no one wants to undermine the stability of Turkey, at least officially. Or when Israel carries out attacks on Gaza or Lebanon or Sabra and Shatila, the massacres. No one did anything about that or undermine Israel's sovereignty from a Western perspective. But in the case of Syria, we saw immediately those same extremist forces that helped to overthrow the Libyan government, and the United States knew about this,
and
they helped them do it. And these same forces, along with others, went through Turkey initially into Syria and created a civil war. We know from the very beginning that alongside the nonviolent protesters, there were violent protesters as well. Even the Arab League observer mission, which was created by the Qataris and the Saudis, these two Wahhabi regimes that are by no means democracies, they too stated when they went to Syria that there was a third force firing both on ordinary people and on the government. And as soon as this report came out, the Arab League observer mission was discredited by Western media, by the Saudis, and by the Qataris. So what we see right now is exactly what we were predicting from the beginning, that the rise of an extremist force has now devastated much of the country. It's become a global threat. And recently, we see even American officials admitting that, like General Flynn, who was the former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency. He said that U.S. allies were supporting the extremists. He said that the United States took a willful decision to side with their allies. So the United States is implicated in the rise of ISIL.
And we're seeing that more. Mark, if I can go to you, over the last few days, if you look at the major broadsheets in the United States and the UK, this is an opportunity to double down on 5 more years of what we've seen here. This is really quite a remarkable, particularly since we have a president that is, if not in the Oval Office, he's on the golf course right now. A lot of people are saying we should be planning, the U.S. should be planning, and its Western allies, an attack on Syria.
Not really, Peter. Because doubling down would entail doing more of what you're already doing.
Well, they're going to be enhancing
quote-unquote. That is probably what the Obama administration will, this lame duck administration will end up doing for the last 2 months as it runs out the clock. But what the mainstream establishment papers, the foreign policy elite blob in the United States, are braying for is escalation. They are calling for a war on Syria and on Russia and, of course, by extension, Iran as well. And they are demanding it in the most hysterical and unhinged tones at this point. And it has gone from them to U.S. diplomats, John Kerry at the Security Council, Samantha Powers. I mean, these are countries that are waging an illegal six-year proxy war via militants allied with al-Qaeda calling Russia a war criminal. I mean, blaming Russia for violating international law.
And this is going on all while we see Saudi Arabia plummeting, the poor country of Yemen, one of the poorest countries in the world, being destroyed by one of the richest. It's really quite real. And there's not much mention of it in mainstream media. Okay.
And on that note, last week there was an article by the editorial team in the New York Times, and this article was just calling for war. I mean, it was Iraq WMDs all over again, and we all know what the New York Times did in order to prop up the war against Iraq. And you read this article paragraph by paragraph, and it's not only about Russia in Syria. It's about Russia in Ukraine. It's about what Vladimir Putin has done to the world. It's about how Russia must be stopped. I mean, it is an all-out call for full-on war with Russia by the New York Times, the liberal paper of record.
If I go back to Tehran, I suppose we have to assume, sadly, that any kind of negotiations like we saw with the first two ceasefires, that's completely a moot point right now. But we have to point out to our viewers that Russia has taken some very significant precautions to protect its own personnel. And I would like to ask all three of you, has Russia effectively put in its own no-fly zone over Syria? Go ahead, in Tehran.
I think it's obvious that the United States is going to face major problems if it tries to escalate in Syria. Russia has obviously increased its presence in the country, and the Iranians have said from the very beginning that they will not allow Damascus to fall. And the Iranians will make sure that that does not happen. So it's best for the United States to carefully calculate what it does before it initiates any action. It already made horrific mistakes in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And the United States has lost the war in Yemen. We have to remember that the outrage in Yemen, the crimes against humanity that are being carried out on a daily basis, the bombing of weddings, the bombing of schools and hospitals, we've now even seen yesterday, a couple of days ago, the bombing of a funeral where over 100 people were massacred by the Saudis. The United States have been supporting the Saudis, and so have the British and the French. They are just as implicated in these crimes against humanity. President Obama is just as much guilty of murder as is the Saudi king and the deputy crown prince.
It's very interesting that, you know, we hear this is barbarism, but this is the word that is being used by the United States. Accusing Russia and the Syrian government of barbarism when they're fighting terrorism on the ground. I mean, again, this whole rhetoric is Orwellian, Mark, because we see the same thing happening right there. But then, you know, you and I were talking earlier. These groups that are fighting against the government in Syria, they're very rarely given real names. They're just called rebels. I think that's very telling.
Yeah, and as Western experts from a variety of institutions, the Century Foundation, Brookings, the Atlantic Council, have admitted that the overarching umbrella for the rebellion right now is Nusra, that is al-Qaeda, Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, the Army for the Conquest of Syria, as they call it now. And you have a whole range of splinter groups off of like that, like Ahrar al-Sham, Jund al-Aqsa, Jaish al-Islam. These are all radical, Salafist, jihadist, head-chopping, suicide bombing
terrorists. And they have access to growing sophistication and weaponry from
the end user, of course, is the United States. If they are not directly providing the weapons via middlemen like Saudi Arabia and Qatar, then they are the ones providing for shipments of weapons like a flood of Grad missiles now that are coming from European countries like Slovakia, Bulgaria, and others it's all being directed through Turkey. And we've got reports of shipments of man pads now, which has long been a no-no because, of course, of the threat to for international terrorism, and advanced U.S. anti-tank missiles, TOWS, and a flood of these indiscriminate GRAD multiple rocket launch systems.
And Mark, sometimes these missiles are accidentally dropped in the desert by accident.
Yeah.
So we can't forget these little accidental mistakes that the government makes to arm these moderate rebels, and they end up in the wrong hands.
Interesting, Alex, one of the things I find interesting, we're getting into a game of brinksmanship right now. Obviously, there are forces in the U.S. that would love to give, quote-unquote, Russia a bloody nose. The problem with brinksmanship is that it's hard to control escalation.
You know, I think there really is a civil war at play here, but I think the civil war is happening in Washington.
Oh, yeah.
You have the State Department, you have the Pentagon, you have Obama, you have Kerry, Samantha Powers, Ash Carter. All of them are trying to push an agenda, the CIA, an agenda that is not congruent. There's not one congruent policy on Syria. And you had Ash Carter just a week or two ago literally just tell Obama, I don't care what
maybe
you say.
Maybe yes,
you do.
Maybe no.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, in a few months, that'll be gone. When Clinton
takes let me go to Tehran before we go to the break here. Mohammed, I mean, sitting in Tehran, how do you see the political leadership struggle in the United States in the waning days of the Obama administration? Who do you listen to? Do you listen to everyone or no one? Go ahead.
Well, I think the view here is that there really isn't a policy. On the one hand, Carter says one thing. On the other hand, Kerry negotiates something else. We don't even know what Obama's position is. Kerry, when the deal was signed, the ceasefire, although the Iranians were very skeptical from the start, just like in February when the ceasefire only served the needs of the extremists because the Americans gave them new weapons. But in this case, the Iranians saw that when Kerry finally negotiated the agreement, the defense secretary went and said, we don't agree with it. And then we saw the air strikes against Syrian positions, which was a signal.
Let me jump in here, guys. We have to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on stories in the media state, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing some of the latest events regarding Syria. Okay, Mark, let me go to you. Let's talk about what's on a lot of people's mind right now. We've already discussed the kind of rhetoric that's coming out of Washington. Alex pointed out it's very difficult to delineate between the white noise that we hear from different power structures in the United States. Mark, you're a former military man. Are we facing a possible major conflict, and I mean including the United States, Russia, obviously Syria? We heard from Mohammed in Tehran that Iran will not let Damascus fall to a black flag. Iran could be involved. We would have Saudi Arabia. We have Israel. What's your take at this point in time?
Yeah, first concentrate. There are several conflicts involved. The Saudi-Iran, the internal conflict. Let me focus first on the U.S.-Russia, the global proxy war content of that. Hillary Clinton is about to take office, and she has reiterated many times. She has said that America's priority, meaning her priority in Syria, is to get rid of Assad. It is
another regime change
in another Middle East country. Her presumed defense secretary, Michel Flournoy, is a chicken hawk of epic proportions. Yes, I believe that once Clinton takes office, the Central Intelligence Agency, new people will be moved into the military brass, the Joint Chiefs, and they believe that Russia and other countries like Iran needs to be given a bloody nose, to be taught who is the hegemon and who sets the rules of what they call their new liberal world order, vice the UN world order of sovereignty and territorial defense of states. And if I could give you a quote here from a Twitter conversation I had with one of the neocon ideologues, of all of this, at Brookings, Shadi Hamid, the author of Islamic Exceptionalism. he said this week on Twitter, the anti-imperialist left is an untenable position. It wants to imagine a better world, but that better world is impossible without U.S. military force. We cannot have a better world unless if it comes under the jackboots.
It's surreal.
As an ex-military man, the young military American boys and girls in uniform, they don't want to play hegemonic crusader around the world. They only want to defend their country. This is mad neocons geopolitical fantasy.
But, you know, Alex, it's really interesting, given what we've said on the program already, is that, you know, when we look at the Western mainstream media, they're fully prepared now. You know, somebody just has to say, go!
they're preparing the public for war.
Okay, I mean, it's fascinating.
Absolutely.
How Russia has been played into the American presidential campaign, yeah, with almost without a shred of evidence, just innuendo, and that's good enough, apparently.
Yeah, Clinton laid it out perfectly to demonize Russia and to put into the fabric of her accession into the White House. And the fear is that once Clinton does take office, we will have some sort of war. What that war means, we don't really know. It's obvious that Obama is trying to run out the clock. I don't think he wants this on his legacy. And that's what he's really concerned about. I don't think he's concerned about Syria, solving the problems, anything. He's concerned about his legacy.
He doesn't have much of one.
No kidding. Well, yeah. I mean, after 8 years, the only thing he worries about is his legacy. That's quite remarkable. Mohammed, if I go back to you in Iran, it's your neighborhood here. From the perspective of Tehran, I mean, looking at these two ceasefires, particularly the second one, which, at least for I think most people that I know, in common sense, is that Ashton Carter sabotaged that by attacking the Syrian military. From the perspective of Tehran, that probably doesn't bode very well.
Well, I think that here the view is that the Americans weren't negotiating in good faith anyway. Kerry knew quite well that the United States either would not or could not separate the so-called moderates from the extremists. Of course, there are no moderates. Even the U.S. Vice President said that before. The moderates are people like the ones who beheaded the 12-year-old boy on video, and they put it on YouTube. These are the American moderates. But Al-Zinki. And so the people here did not have any confidence that the second ceasefire would get anywhere, because the United States basically wanted the extremists to be able to regroup, and they want to spare the extremists in Aleppo. And this is one of the ironies. The United States considers the Syrian government, the Russians, the Iranians, and others responsible for the situation in Aleppo, whereas in fact the reality is that Al-Qaeda is controlling eastern Aleppo, which constitutes 10-15% of the population.
Right.
The government has to force them out. And these are the same people who carried out 9/11, remember. And on the other hand, the 85% of the population of Aleppo is in western Aleppo. And many people from eastern Aleppo went to western Aleppo when that part of the city was occupied. And that part of the city is constantly being attacked. Mortars and shells are being fired into west Aleppo, and nothing is ever said in the western media. So it's obvious what needs to happen. The extremists have to be defeated, but the United States wants to spare them because they need them in future when they want to bring about regime change in Syria, or when they think that they at some point they can bring about regime change in Syria. But I think that's impossible. The world is changing, and the United States does not have the power that it used to have. Saudi Arabia is on the decline, and rapidly. So there's talk of devaluation in the Saudi currency. It's moving towards instability. It cannot continue these wars. Yemen is a major threat to Saudi stability. Iraq is much stronger today than it was before, and Iraq will not allow Syria to fall. So I think that if the next president makes the stupid mistake of carrying out a war against Syria, the price will be very heavy, and the United States would definitely fail.
You know, Mark, Mohammed brings up a really good point, and I agree with him, but By agreeing with him, I think the situation becomes even more risky right now. And this is what I fear the most, because what we saw Turkey shoot down a Russian aircraft, okay? And we know the backstory of that now. It was very calculated. And I would assume, because after the attack on Syrian forces by the Americans, the mysterious destruction of the humanitarian convoy, which isn't very mysterious to me, and I think a lot of other thinking people here, this is going to be a calculated or not so calculated risk to shoot down a Russian plane intentionally and to see what Russia's reaction is going to be.
Yeah, I think you're right that we do have a fading unipolar moment, a fading hegemon. But that's when it becomes most dangerous.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Because it realizes it has a limited window of opportunity with the rise of Russia, China, other regional powers like Iran to make geopolitical facts on the ground, to set nations on political courses through regime change and others that are more amenable to their interests. Specifically with the events in Aleppo, we hear a lot of bleeding from the Western media, the crocodile tears about concerns about citizens in East Aleppo. Of course, no concerns about citizens in Yemen or West Aleppo. Any number of places like Fallujah, which the U.S. has leveled in its counterterrorist operations.
And they give the impression it's the government that's besieging the population.
And they completely ignore. The media was still, this week, New York Times, was putting what Russia calls terrorists in scare quotes. And this comes right after the U.N. envoy to Syria, De Mistura, made a personal appeal to save the civilians that are literally being held hostage as human shields by al-Qaeda and their friends, these other jihadist groups. And he admitted that a large portion of the force was al-Qaeda. And he personally offered, in a kind of a very cynical way, to save al-Qaeda's dignity. Let them walk out of Aleppo with their weapons. He would personally escort them and take them to Idlib or wherever they wanted to go. I wish he would take them to Washington or to London or Brussels rather than to another portion of Syria. But when the UN envoy is admitting that he is trying to get al-Qaeda out of the city, right, so, you know, the law and order can be restored, and the Western press is still putting terrorists in scare quotes.
And it falls on deaf ears with policymakers, because every time there is a plausible, even if it's minute, plausible possibility to bring a ceasefire, to start moving towards some kind of peaceful resolution, even political transition at some point here, it's stopped dead in its tracks. We see incidences all of the time. And this, again, what really worries me is that we're going to see an incident where we're going to have a game of chicken.
Well, I think it goes without question that once Hillary comes into office, we're going to see some sort of incident. We just don't know at what scale it's going to be, because we can't forget that we have the ultimate neocon about to become president of the United States. She's corrupt, she's compromised, but she also follows the Wolfowitz doctrine.
The neocons, Kagan and others, have left the Republican Party flocking to her
band. There's no difference between liberals, neoliberals now, and neocons. They've melded into one kind of ideology.
Yeah, liberal interventionist, neocon.
Exactly.
Same thing.
And I think right now, one thing that you're seeing in Syria is you also don't see a lot of the Western media talking about Iran, talking about the Syrian army, talking about any of the other forces that are trying to liberate Aleppo. It's not a siege, it's a liberation. And I think that's because the media understands that the American public can only handle one bad guy at a time.
When we're talking about this bloody nose that they think Russia needs to be given, they think that a limited military conventional conflict with Russia in a isolated theater like Syria is possible. Despite the risk of World War III, they are willing to go there.
Yes. Yes, they are.
In
Hillary
order
Clinton is willing to go there.
To enforce their
agenda. Let me give the last word to Mohammed in Iran. How pessimistic are you of some kind of a major conflict, even if it's limited, when we see a new president in the White House in the next year? Go ahead.
Well, look, I know how dirty the United States can play. I was a victim of two chemical attacks by Saddam Hussein's army, and the United States and the British and the Germans and the other European countries gave them those chemical weapons to use. So I don't underestimate the sort of behavior that the Americans can have when it comes to destroying countries and killing
people. Okay, on that point, gentlemen, we've run out of time.
But the United States is a much weaker country.
Okay, on that note there, we've run out of time, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests.
So get ready, America. The bitch will come up with some kind of war not too long after she becomes president. It'll probably be an attack on Syria, the way they're talking. But she wants to go after Iran, and even trying to bait Russia into some kind of situation. So they want a bitch. They're going to get a bitch. So get ready to send more white and otherwise Americans into these situations where they're going to come back in pieces again. But the people going to want her. They want her. They love her. The bitch is on the rise. And that's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow. I'm not sure whether we're going to have an archive show or not. I have to be out of the bunker for a couple of sessions in a couple of days. But you'll get your show every day because my webmaster takes care of that stuff for me.